He stood right where you're standing and told me how much he hated that city. The heat, the traffic, those damn theme parks everywhere you look. I shake my head, desperation raising my voice like a siren. He's been so stressed. Maybe he didn't know the conference had been moved. Maybe that's where he's been all this time, roaming around the scorching Orlando streets, trying to track down the new location. But then, why not call me back? Claire presses her lips together, and she doesn't respond. I close my eyes for a few erratic heartbeats, the emotions exploding like bombs in my chest. What do I do? Who do I call? My first instinct is to call Will, like I do whenever I have a problem I can't figure out myself. His methodical mind sees things differently than mine, can almost always plot a path to the solution. You should design an app, I told him once, after he'd helped me chart out an entire semester's worth of drug and alcohol awareness programs. You'd make a fortune. You could call it, What Will Will Say? He'd patted his lap, smiling my favorite smile.
Right now, he says you're adorable, and to get over here and give me a kiss.
Now, I press my fingers to my lips and tell myself to calm down, to think. There must be someone I can call, someone who will tell me this is all just one huge misunderstanding. Jessica! I pop off the stool and sprint to the phone, resting on a charger by the microwave. Jessica will know where he is. She'll know where the conference was moved. Who's Jessica? Will's assistant. I punch in the number I know by heart, turning my back on Claire so I don't see her creased brow, her averted gaze, the way she's chewing her lip. She's humoring me, just like Ted did.
AppSec Consulting, Jessica speaking.
Jessica, it's Iris Griffith. Have you...
Iris, I thought y'all were on vacation.
Her comment comes so far out of left field, it takes me a couple of seconds to reboot. Jessica may be a whiz at answering phones and coordinating the schedules of a bunch of disorganized techies, but she's not got the fastest processor in the cache.
No. What makes you think that?
Because you're supposed to be on an all-inclusive baby-making vacation to the Mayan Riviera. Will showed me pictures of the resort, and it looks
She swallows the rest of the word, then sucks in a breath.
Oh, God, Iris, I must be confused. I'm sure I got the weeks mixed up.
I know what Jessica is thinking. She's thinking he's there with another woman. And I don't even care, because what if she's right? What if Will is alive and well and lounging on a beach in Mexico? Hope hangs inside me for a second or two, then fizzles when I realize that he wouldn't. Will would never cheat, and even if he did, Mexico would be the very last destination on my heat-hating husband's list. A cruise to Alaska would be more like it.
He can't be in Mexico,
I say, and it's everything I can do to keep my voice calm, to smother my frustration in a coating of civility.
He's one of the keynotes for the cybersecurity conference, remember?
What conference?
My eyes go wide. Why would anyone at AppSec ever hire this woman? The one in Orlando?
Wait, I'm confused. So he's not in Mexico?
And Lord help me, this is where I lose it. I suck a breath and scream into the phone loud enough to burn the back of my throat.
I don't know, Jessica. I don't fucking know where Will is. That's the whole fucking problem.
Shocked silence all around, from Claire behind me and from Jessica on the other end of the line. It's like silence in stereo, ringing in both ears. I should apologize. I know I should. But a sob steals my breath, and I choke on the awful words that come next.
They're saying Will was on that flight that crashed this morning, but that can't be right. He was on a plane to Orlando.
Tell me he's in Orlando.
Oh, my God. I saw the news, but I had no idea, Iris. I didn't know.
Please, just help me find Will.
Of course. She falls silent for a moment, and I hear her clicking around a computer keyboard. I'm positive I didn't book his flight for today, but I have his login credentials for the airline accounts. What airline was the plane that crashed again?
Liberty Airlines, Flight 23.
Another longish pause, filled with more clicking. Okay, I'm in. Let's see, Flight 23, you said? I drop both elbows on the countertop, cradle my head in one hand, squeeze my eyes shut, pray.
Yes.
I hold my breath, and I hear the answer, in the way Jessica sucks in hers.
Oh, Iris,
she says, and the room spins.
I'm so sorry, but here it is, Flight 23, leaving Atlanta this morning at 8:55 a.m., headed to Seattle, and returning on, looks like he booked a one-way.
My legs give out, and I slide onto the floor.
Check Delta?
Iris, I'm not sure.
Check Delta!
Okay, just give me a second or two. It's loading now. Wait, that's so weird. He's here, too. Flight 2069 to Orlando. Leaving today at 9 a.m. Returning Friday at 8 p.m. Why would he book two tickets in opposite directions? Relief turns my bones to slush, and I sit up ramrod straight.
Where's the conference? I called the hotel on Universal Boulevard, but it must have been moved.
Sorry, Iris. I don't know anything about a conference.
So ask somebody. Surely somebody there knows about the conference your own company planned.
No. What I meant was, APSEC doesn't have any conferences on the books. Not until early November.
It takes me three tries to get my next words out. And Mexico?
The tickets aren't on Delta or Liberty Air. But I can check the other airlines if you'd like.
There's pity in her voice now, and I can't listen to it for another second.
I hang up and Google the phone number for Delta. It takes me 9 eternal minutes to make it through the queue. And then I explain my situation to a procession of customer service representatives before I finally land with Carrie, the perky-voiced family assistance representative.
Hi, Carrie. My name is Iris Griffith. My husband, Will, was booked on this morning's flight 2069 from Atlanta to Orlando, and I haven't heard from him since he landed. Could you maybe check and make sure he made the flight okay?
Certainly, ma'am. I just need his ticket locator number. Which would mean hanging up and calling Jessica back. And there's no way I'm giving up my place in the phone line. I need answers now.
Can't you find him by name? I really need to know if he was on the flight.
I'm afraid that's impossible. Her voice is sing-song and chipper, delivering the bad news like I just won a free meal at Denny's. Privacy restrictions will not allow us to give out passenger itineraries over the phone.
But he's my husband. I'm his wife.
I understand that, ma'am. And if I could verify your marital status over the phone, I would. Perhaps you could drop by your nearest Delta counter with a valid identification. Someone there.
I don't have time to go to a Delta counter!
The words erupt from the deepest part of my gut, surprising me with both their suddenness and force. And the woman on the other end of the line goes absolutely still. If it weren't for the background noises, computer clicks, and human chatter, I'd think she hung up on me. And then there's a high-pitched squeal, like interference on a microphone, and it takes a second or two to identify the sound as my own. I break under the weight of my desperation.
It's just that he also had a ticket on Liberty Air Flight 23, you know? But he wasn't supposed to be on that airplane. He was supposed to be on yours. And now he's not returning my calls, and the hotel doesn't have any record of him or the conference, and neither does his assistant, even though she thought he was in Mexico, which he most definitely is not. And now, with each second that passes, seconds where I don't know where my husband is, I'm losing more and more of my mind. So please, take a peek in your computer and tell me if he was on that flight. I'm begging you.
She clears her throat.
Mrs. Griffith, I...
Please.
My voice breaks on the word, and it takes a couple of tries before I find it again. The tears are coming hard and fast now, hogging my air and clogging my throat.
Please, help me find my husband.
There's a long, long pause, and I clasp the phone so tightly, my fingers ache.
I'm sorry,
she says after an eternity, her voice barely above a whisper.
But your husband never checked in for flight 2069.
I scream and hurl my phone across the room. It bounces off the cabinet and lands face down on the tiles, and I don't have to look to know it's shattered. I spend the rest of the afternoon in bed, fully clothed and bundled in Will's bathrobe, fuming under my comforter. Will lied. He fucking lied.
No, he didn't just lie. He lied and then backed up his lie with a fake conference, one he corroborated with more lies, and a fake full-color flyer that's a masterpiece of desktop publishing. Fury fires in my throat and grips me by the guts and overshadows every other thought.
How could Will do such a thing? Why would he go to all that trouble? I am shaking so hard, my bones vibrate. Mostly because now there's no reason for him to have been on a plane to Orlando. My parents arrive just before dark, like they said they would. From under my layers of cotton and feathers, I hear their muted voices talking to Claire downstairs. I imagine my mother's horrified expression when Claire tells them about my breakdown at school and the phone calls with Jessica and the Delta agent. I see Mom crane her neck toward the staircase with obvious longing on her face, the way she'd hurriedly wrap up the conversation with Claire so she could rush up the stairs to me. 2 seconds after a car starts outside on the driveway, a body sinks onto the edge of my bed.
Oh, darling, my sweet, sweet Iris.
Her voice is soft, but her consonants are hard and pointy. Along with her love of meat and potatoes, a stubborn sign of her Dutch heritage. As awful as it sounds, I can't face my mother. Not yet. I know what I will see if I throw off the covers. Mom's eyes, red-rimmed and swollen and filled with pity. And I know what the sight of them will do to me.
Your father and I are just heartbroken. We loved Will. And we will miss him terribly. But my heart breaks most of all for you, my sweet baby girl.
Tears prick my eyes. I'm not ready to speak of Will in past tense, and I can't bear for anyone else to either.
Mom, please, I need a minute.
Take all the time that you need, Lievert. You know Mom is devastated when the endearments revert back to her native tongue. The bed shifts, and she stands.
Your brother will be here by 9. James was in surgery when they got the news, so they only just left Savannah an hour ago.
She pauses as if waiting for a reply, but when she doesn't get one, she adds,
Oh, shut ya. Is there anything I can do?
Yes. You can bring me Will. I need to wring his neck. Chapter 6. I wake up, and the first thing I think is, where's Will? Where is my husband? The clock says it's 17 past midnight. I strain for the sound of water running in the bathroom, for the slap of bare feet on the closet hardwoods. but other than heated air whistling through the vents, our bedroom is quiet. The day comes roaring back like a head-on collision. Will, airplane, dead. Pain steals my breath, stretching from my forehead to my heels. Terror overwhelms me, and I lurch upright in bed, flipping on the light and sucking deep breaths until the walls stop pushing in on me. I flip down the covers and reach for the divot in the mattress where Will's body lay only yesterday. Without Will in it, our king-sized bed has grown to the size of an ocean liner, swallowing me up with all the emptiness. I run a palm over his pillowcase, pluck at a couple dark hairs caught in the cool cotton. I close my eyes, and I can still feel him, physically feel the heat of his skin, the scratch of his beard sliding across my shoulder blade, the weight of him rolling onto me, my own gasp as he pushes inside. One minute he's here, the next he's gone, like a morbid magician's disappearing act. And now I'm supposed to believe he's in pieces on a Missouri cornfield? I can't wrap my head around the concept. It's sheer insanity. Climbing out of bed is like swimming upstream. My body is heavy, my limbs sluggish and stiff, and there's a vice clamping down on my lungs that makes it hard to breathe. I'm still in Will's robe, and it's all tangled and twisted around my body. I loosen the belt, rewrap the terry cloth around my torso, and retie everything snug around my waist. It still swims on me, but it's warm and comfortable, and it smells like Will, all of which means I may never take it off. Downstairs, the kitchen television flashes blue and white streaks in the darkness, muted coverage of the crash. I stand there for a long moment, staring at a reporter before a field of charred earth and steaming chunks of metal. And it strikes me that he might be enjoying this a little too much. His eyes are too big, his brow too furrowed, everything about him too theatrical. He's waited his entire career for a story like this one. Better make it good. Behind me, the lump on the couch shifts. My twin brother, Dave, in a Georgia Bulldog sweatshirt and plaid pajama pants.
"Been wondering when you'd get down here," he says in his deep, dusky bass that makes him sound like a sports announcer instead of the realtor he is. He lights up a joint the size of a cigar and sucks in a lungful, patting the cushion next to him. "I'm telling Mom." Other than crying, it's the first time I've used my voice in almost 7 hours, and my throat feels scratchy and sore. I plop down on the couch.
"My husband's a doctor,"
Dave says through held breath.
"It's medicinal."
I snort. "Sure it is." He offers me a toke, but I shake my head. I'm already a wreck. Probably not the best idea to throw marijuana, medicinal or otherwise, into the mix. We sit under the cloud of sweet-smelling smoke for a long while in silence, watching the muted images on the screen. The carnage is too much to take in, so I concentrate instead on the reporter's solemn face. He gestures for the cameraman to follow him over to a giant hunk of fuselage, then points to an abandoned, child-sized shoe, and I try to read his lips.
"What a hungry sticker. Cheese, candy, a goat and 3 trolls.
How do deaf people do this?" The reporter's forehead crumples into rows and rows of squiggles, and Dave shakes his head.
"That motherfucker is having entirely too much fun."
Everything you've ever heard about twins is true. Dave and I are living proof. We look alike, we act alike, we share the same habits and gestures. We both have fat lips and bony knuckles. We'll watch any sport, but can't stand playing them. And we refuse to eat anything that has the slightest dash of vinegar in it. We even have twin telepathy, this inexplicable connection that lets us know what the other is thinking without either of us saying a word. Case in point, I knew he was gay before he had figured it out for himself. He stubs the joint out on a teacup saucer, already littered with ashes, and sets it on the side table.
Just so you know, Ma is a wreck. She's already brought home one of everything from Kroger, and she's got a list a half mile long of all the things she's going to fill your freezer with. If you don't let her coddle you soon, you're going to have enough food here to open a soup kitchen.
Coddling would make it real. I sigh and press into him, leaning my head on his shoulder. I keep telling myself it's not. That Will is going to walk through that door on Friday evening, hot and rumpled and grumpy. And I'll get to scream, "I told you so. I told you Will wasn't on that plane." I keep waiting for someone to pinch me, to take me by both shoulders and shake me so I'll wake up. But so far, nothing. I'm stuck in a fucking nightmare.
Sure as hell feels like it.
He picks up my hand, twines his fingers through mine, rolling the ring around with a thumb.
Nice Cartier.
I blink back new tears. Will and I are trying to get pregnant. You might be an uncle already. Dave looks at me for a good 30 long and silent seconds. He doesn't say a word, but then again, he doesn't have to.
How long are we going to keep this up? His eyes say. This talking about Will like he's still here.
As long as humanly possible, my answer. But when it comes to the pregnancy, he doesn't seem the least bit surprised.
What took y'all so long? James and I figured you'd have an entire brood by now.
Will wanted to wait. He said he wanted me all to himself for a while.
What changed his mind?
I have to think about that one for a moment. I don't know. And honestly, I never thought to ask. I was just so excited he finally came around. He says he wants a little girl who looks like me. But if this is all true, if I really am stuck in this nightmare, I hope it's a little boy who's just like him.
Even after the conference that wasn't?
Of course Dave knows about Will's invented conference. I'm sure my mother dragged it out of Claire, then dissected his lie for hours with anybody who would listen. I'm sure she's come up with a long list of theories as to why Will would do such a thing, why he would go to the trouble of creating a conference flyer, why he would book two flights to opposite ends of the country. But of course, I already know the answer, so I wouldn't know where he was going, what he was going to do there, who he was going to see. Any or all of the above. The helpless fury that had me shaking under my comforter earlier threatens to bubble to the surface, and I swallow it back down. I love my husband. I miss him and want him back. The emotions are so big and wide, they leave no room for anger. I barter with a god I'm not entirely sure I believe in. Bring Will back. And I won't even ask where he's been. I promise. I won't even care. One lie doesn't negate 7 years of marriage, Dave. Does it piss me off? Maybe. But it can't erase the love I feel for my husband. He concedes the point with a one-shouldered shrug.
Of course not. But can I ask you something else without you biting my head off?
He pauses, and I give him a reluctant nod.
What's in Seattle? Besides rain and Starbucks and too much plaid, I mean.
I lift both hands. Beats the hell out of me. Will grew up in Memphis, and he moved to Atlanta straight out of grad school at University of Tennessee. His entire life is here on the East Coast. I've never even heard him talk of Seattle. As far as I know, he's never been there. I twist on the couch, stare into cat eyes, the same dark olive shade as mine. But what you're really asking is, do I think Will is having an affair? Dave gives me a slow nod.
Do you?
My stomach twists, not because I think my husband was cheating on me, but because everybody else surely will. No, but I don't think he was on that plane either, so clearly I've not got the tightest grip on reality. What do you think?
Dave falls silent for a long moment, contemplating his answer.
I have a lot of unanswered questions when it comes to my brother-in-law. Don't get me wrong, I adore the guy, mostly because of how fiercely he loves you. You can't fake that kind of love, the kind that, every time you walk into the room, fills his face with so much happiness that I have to turn away, and I'm a gay man. I eat that shit up. So, to answer your question, no, I don't think your husband was having an affair.
My heart, which was already hanging by a thread, cracks in two. Not just at Dave's belief in my husband, or his talking about him like he's still here, but more so, that my brother's love for me is so intense, it extends by default to another person. I curl my palm around his biceps and lay my head on his shoulder, thinking I've never loved Dave more.
Anyway, what I'm trying to say is, Will came into your life solo. His parents are dead. He has no siblings. He never talks about any other family or friends. Everybody has a past, but it's like his life began when he met you.
Dave is only partly right. Will has a lot of colleagues and acquaintances, but not a lot of friends. But that's because for techies like Will, it takes a lot for him to open up. I sit up, twist on the couch to face my brother. Because he lost track of all his high school friends except for one, and he's moved off to Costa Rica. He runs a surfing school there or something. I know they still exchange regular emails.
What about all the others? Friends, old neighbors, workout partners, and drinking buddies.
Men don't collect friends like women do. Dave gives me a look, and I amend. Heterosexual men don't collect them. They don't feel the need to run with a huge pack of people. And besides, you know Will. He'd rather be at home on his laptop than in a loud, crowded bar any day. It's part of the reason we eloped to the mountains of North Carolina 7 years ago, with only my parents and Dave and James as witnesses. Will doesn't like crowds, and he hates people fussing over him.
Even introverts have a best friend, Dave says. Who's Will's?
That's an easy one. I open my mouth to answer, but Dave beats me to the punch.
Besides you, I mean.
I press down on my lips. Now that my name is off the table, Dave's question has me perplexed. Will talks about a lot of people he knows, but he never really defines them as friends. Dave yawns and slumps deeper into the couch, and it's not long before he forgets his question and nods off. I sit there next to my snoring brother, watching the horrific images flash by on the television screen, but not really seeing them. I'm thinking about our first anniversary, when I surprised Will with a road trip to Memphis. I'd spent weeks planning it, my version of a This Is Your Life tour along all his old haunts, puzzling the stops together from the few stories he told me of growing up there. His high school alma mater, the street where he'd lived until his mother died, the Pizza Hut where he'd worked evening and weekend shifts. But the closer we got to the city, the more he fidgeted, and the quieter he became. Finally, on a barren stretch of I-40, he admitted the truth. Will's childhood wasn't pleasant, and his memories of Memphis weren't exactly something he wanted to revisit. Once was hard enough. We hung a U-turn and spent the weekend exploring Nashville's honky-tonks instead. So, no. Will didn't like to talk about his past. But Seattle? What's there? Who's there? I look over at my sleeping brother, at his chest rising and falling in the darkness. As much as I want to keep Dave's suspicions at bay, to barricade his doubts about Will from my brain, the questions sneak back in like smoke, silent and choking. How well
do I know my husband?
Chapter 7. When I come downstairs next, it's close to 10 in the morning. My family is scattered around the kitchen, drinking coffee, and listening to James read news of the crash aloud from a website on his iPad. From where he's seated at the table, Dad coughs into a fist. James stops mid-sentence, and they look at me with a combination of guilt and concern, like four kids I caught stealing from my cookie jar. "They found the black box," I say without preamble. Mom drops the spatula into a skillet of half-cooked eggs and whirls around, looking like she didn't fare much better than I did in the sleeping department. Dark circles spread under her eyes like bruises, and her hair, normally an inspired work of hot roller wizardry, hangs listless around her puffy face.
"Oh, sweetheart."
She rushes across the kitchen tile, snatching me into a ferocious hug.
"My heart is just breaking for you. Is there anything I can do? Anything you need?"
"There are a million things I need. I need to know what made Will board that plane. I need to know what happened to make it fall from the sky. I need to know what his last moments were like. If he went down screaming or without warning. If one moment he was debating peanuts versus pretzels and the next he was dust. I need to know where he is, literally and exactly. Will there be a body to bury? But most of all, I need Will to be where he said he was going to be, in Orlando." I untangle myself from Mom's arms. I look to James, since he was the one reading the news.
"Do they know why it crashed?"
"It'll be months before they say for sure," James says, his voice careful.
He takes me in with his blue-eyed doctor's gaze, methodical and thorough, like he's trying to take my pulse from the other side of the kitchen counter.
"How did you sleep?"
I shake my head. I didn't miss the way everyone exchanged looks at my question about the crash, and I sure as hell don't want to talk about my lack of sleep.
"Just tell me, James."
He hauls a breath, his gaze sliding over my right shoulder to Dave, as if asking for permission. Dave must have nodded, because James's gaze returns to mine.
"Keep in mind, this is just a theory at this point, but the media is speculating a mechanical problem followed by pilot error."
"Pilot error."
The words come out sluggish, like my tongue is coated in molasses. James nods.
"Pilot error, as in, somebody fucked up, and now my husband is dead."
James grimaces.
"I'm sorry, Iris, but it sure sounds that way."
Bile rises in my throat, and the room sways.
Or maybe it's just me.
James hops off his stool and rushes around the counter, steadying me with a palm around my elbow.
"Would you like me to give you something? I can't medicate your grief away, but a pill can help take the edge off, at least for the next few days."
I shake my head. My grief, as spiky as it is, feels like the only thing binding me to Will. The thought of losing that connection, even the rawest, sharpest edges of it, fills me with panic.
"I wouldn't say no to a Xanax," Dave says.
James gives me a look, one like, "You're crazy, brother," then pats my arm.
"Think about it, okay? I can write you a prescription for whatever you need."
I give him my best attempt at a smile.
"Come."
My mother steers me to the kitchen island, overflowing with food. A platter of scrambled eggs, a mini mountain of bacon and sausage swimming in grease, an entire loaf of toasted bread. For Mom, there's no better way of demonstrating her love than with heavy, hearty food. And this morning, her love is big enough to feed an army.
"What would you like?"
I take in the food, and the smell hits me. Buttery eggs and fried pork grease, doing somersaults in my stomach.
"Nothing."
"You can't not eat.
How about I whip up some pancakes? I'll make the Dutch kind, and load them up with apple and bacon, just the way you like."
Dave looks over from the coffee pot, where he's measuring out the grounds.
"Ma, leave her alone. She'll eat when she's hungry. Come here, squirt.
Dad calls out from his seat at the table, patting the chair beside him.
I saved you a spot.
My father is a former Marine and a brilliant engineer with an easy smile and a halfway decent jump shot, but his greatest talent is running interference between my brother and me and our mother. I sink onto the chair and lean into him, and he slings a beefy arm around my shoulders. My family is not a demonstrative clan. Hugs happen only at hellos and goodbyes. Kisses are rare, and they usually stop just short of skin. So far today, I've held my brother's hand, collapsed in my mother's arms, and snuggled up to my father. This is what death does. It forces intimacy. At the same time, it snatches it away. My gaze falls on the legal pad, covered in Dad's block letter scribbles. Pages and pages of bullet points, grouped into categories and ranked by level of importance. If Will were here, he and my father would bond over the beauty of this list, a masterpiece of left-brained brilliance. I push aside Dad's reading glasses and scan the papers, a string of knots working their way across my shoulder blades. It seems unfair. There are so many tasks to tackle, when all I really want to do is go back to bed and forget yesterday ever happened. And then I notice a grouping of four or five bullets at the bottom. Compensation? I say, and there's venom in my tone.
Airlines provide a sum of money to victims' families, Iris. I know it seems harsh, but I'm just looking out for my baby girl. I will make sure you're provided for.
As if Liberty Air can fix their shoddy planes and bungling pilots by throwing around some cash. Oh, we killed your husband? Here, go buy yourself something nice. I'd rather starve to death than touch a penny of their blood money.
Fine, then don't touch it. Put it in the bank and forget all about it. I'm still going after it for you.
I grab the pen and add my own bullet to the list. Research victims' families' charities. Someone might profit from Liberty Air's money, but it sure as hell won't be me. The next page is more of the first, and after a quick scan, I flip to the next, and then the next, stopping short at what I read across the top. Media. Underneath, my father has created a long and extensive log of calls received, complete with date, time, name of caller, and outlet. I don't recognize all the names, but more than a few jump out at me. People Magazine, The Today Show, The Atlanta Journal-Constitution, Diane Sawyer, USA Today. How did they find me? Our number's unlisted. Dave settles in at the head of the table with an egg and bacon sandwich.
I don't know, but the phone has been ringing off the hook. We unplugged it an hour ago. And last time I looked, there were three news vans parked out front.
Seriously?
Seriously. And you know that photo of you and Will from last New Year's Eve? It's all over the internet.
They could have chosen a worse picture, I suppose. Me and Will in our holiday finest, our faces lit up with goofy grins as he dips me over an arm. I loved it so much, I made it my Facebook profile picture, which, now that I think about it, is probably where they got it. Mom slides a plate with a mini mountain of food in front of me.
Here, Leafia, try to eat at least a few bites.
I pick up my fork, cut off a mini slice of sausage, and push it around my plate until Mom heads back into the kitchen. Dad flips to the next page of his list.
Liberty Airlines has established a family assistance center at the International Terminal at Hartsfield. A lady by the name of...
He slips on his glasses and consults the paper.
Anne Margaret Myers is your point of contact.
Dave snorts around a giant bite of food.
What kind of idiot plans a gathering for plane crash next of kin at the airport? Liberty Air ones, apparently,
Dad says.
They want us down there so they can, and I quote, provide comfort and counseling, discuss plans, and answer any questions.
Plans, I say. What kind of plans?
Well, for starters, they're talking about a memorial service as soon as this weekend.
Dad's gentle tone does nothing to stop a familiar anger from sparking like a flash fire. A Liberty Air memorial service feels like an insult, like the neighbor who buys you flowers after they run over your dog. I won't accept their public display of penitence, and I can't forgive their mistake.
So now I'm supposed to accept help from the people responsible for killing my husband? That's absurd!
I shove my plate to the center of the table, and the pyramid of scrambled eggs landslides over the rim.
I know it seems that way, Pumpkin, but it won't be just Liberty Air. The Red Cross will be there too, as well as folks whose sole job is to collect information about the crash. I want to hear what they know that we haven't gotten from the TV or newspaper.
Maybe you can ask them who alerted the media before my daughter, Mom says, slamming the salt and pepper shakers onto the center of the table.
Because that is an unforgivable blunder, and I'd like to tell that person what I think of them.
Whoever made that mistake will be out of a job. I'll see to it.
Dad uses his drill instructor voice, forceful, booming, and unambiguous. He turns, and his expression morphs from fierce to fiercely concerned.
Sweetheart, like it or not, we're going to have to interface with Liberty Air at some point. I can be the buffer if you want me to, or I can stand back and let you handle it yourself. Up to you. Either way, at the very least, we should go down there and see what this Miss Myers has to say. Don't you think?
No, I don't think. I've seen that footage. Sobbing family members pushing their way through a sea of cameras, keen to capture their despair for all the world to see. And now Dad is suggesting we become a part of them? Then again, I have so many questions, not the least of which is, what did you do to my husband? If this Anne Margaret Myers has an answer for that one, she can plaster my teary, snotty face on the high-definition LED screens at SunTrust Field for all I care.
I push away from the table and head upstairs to get dressed. On the last night of Will's life, he cooked. Not something out of a box or the freezer section, but a whole food, homemade meal. For someone who didn't know how to cut a tomato when I met him, whipping up dinner must have been no easy feat, and it probably took him all day. Maybe something inside him knew what was coming, some otherworldly awareness that his cosmic clock was about to hit zero. But that night, our 7th anniversary, he surprised me with real food, and for the first time ever, made by his own hands. I found him bent over one of my cookbooks in the kitchen, the most amazing smell hanging in the air. What's going on? He whirled around, a twig of thyme dangling from a curl, and a mixture of pride and guilt on his expression.
I'm cooking.
I could see that. Anyone could see that. He'd used every pot and pan we owned, and covered the entire countertop, every single inch, with food and ingredients and cooking utensils. Will was covered in flour and grease. I smiled. What are you making?
Standing rib roast, new potatoes in butter and parsley, and those skinny green beans wrapped in bacon. I forget what they're called.
Haricot vert? He nodded.
I've got dessert, too.
He gestured to 2 chocolate lava cakes and white ramekins, cooling on a rack by the oven. He'd even sprinkled them with powdered sugar. When I didn't respond, he said,
We can still go out if you want to. I just thought,
It's perfect, I said, meaning it. I didn't care that the kitchen was a wreck, or that we'd miss our reservations at the new sushi hotspot in Buckhead. Will cooked, and for me. I smiled and leaned in for a kiss. You're perfect. The meal, however, was not. The roast was overdone, the potatoes were mushy, and the haricot vert were cold, but no food had ever tasted better. I ate every single bite. Afterward, We took the cakes upstairs and devoured them in bed, kissing and licking and growing delirious on chocolate and sex, loving like there was no tomorrow. But tomorrow came. Chapter 8.
Mrs. Griffith, let me begin by expressing my deepest condolences for the loss of your husband.
Dad, Dave, and I are sitting shoulder to shoulder, a united front across from our Liberty Airlines point of contact, Anne Margaret Myers, a thin, blonde woman in a punishing ponytail. The tag hanging from her neck identifies her as care specialist, and I hate her on sight. I hate her starched pink blouse and the way she's buttoned it up all the way to the notch in her throat. I hate her long, French-tipped fingernails and the way she clasps her hands so fiercely together that the skin turns white. I hate her thin lips and her mud puddle eyes and her mask of empathy so exaggerated I have to sit on my hand so I don't punch it off her face. My father leans both forearms onto the wooden table.
Actually, Ms. Myers, we'd like you to begin with an explanation of how the media learned Will's name before his own wife was told he was on the plane.
Anne Margaret's spine goes ramrod straight.
Excuse me?
Dad lifts a shoulder, but the gesture is anything but casual.
You'd think an airline would have better ways of informing the next of kin than releasing the passengers' names to the media. But what do I know? I suppose you folks at Liberty Air have a different way of doing things. What I can tell you is that your policy is a shitty one.
Her lips flap around like a stranded fish, and her gaze flits back and forth between me and my father.
You learned about Mr. Griffith from the news?
The three of us nod, once and in unison.
Oh, my God. I had no idea. I can assure you, Mrs. Griffith, Mr. Stafford, that is absolutely not Liberty Air's policy. Someone over there made a huge, grave error, and I am so very, very sorry.
I know what she's doing. She's distancing herself from both the airline and their mistake, and I'm not buying it. Not even a little bit. And judging from his scowl, neither is my father.
I appreciate that, Ms. Myers, but I'm sure you can understand that an apology from you isn't going to cut it. We'd like an explanation, and we want to hear it from the person responsible.
He leans back and crosses his arms, commanding, authoritative, and in charge. On a good day, my father is someone to be reckoned with. Today, he's supreme command. Anne Margaret is clearly rattled.
I absolutely understand. As soon as we're done here, I will find out what went wrong and then coordinate a face-to-face meeting between that person and your family. Does that sound like an acceptable solution to the three of you?
Dad gives her a curt nod, but I don't move. To me, it sounds like her throwing us a bone. But I'm too tired, too shaken and shattered to say anything without flying across the desk and wrapping my hands around her neck. The room Liberty Airlines has stalled us in is an airline executive lounge in Hartsfield's brand new international terminal. It's plush and roomy, decorated in dark jewel tones, with sitting areas and a bar and an entire wall of windows overlooking the concourse. Airplanes lumber back and forth on the other side of the glass, like giant missiles, taunting me with murderous intent.
Has the press found you yet?
Anne Margaret says, and I turn back to the table. Dave nods.
They've been calling the house all morning, and there are a couple of vans camped out on the street. Some of the reporters even had the nerve to ring the doorbell and ask for an interview.
She shakes her head, disgusted.
We've specifically asked the media outlets to respect the privacy of our families, but not all of the journalists listen. What I can do is make sure you get out of here without having to interact with them. And may I suggest you appoint a family friend to be media contact?
That way, you won't have to talk to them until you're ready.
My father adds another bullet to his list, which has grown to a handful of pages. All around us, people are weeping. A silver-haired man with unshaven cheeks. An Indian woman in a teal and silver sari. A black teenager with diamond studs bigger than my engagement solitaire. Tears roll down their cheeks, unchecked, and the air in the room pulses with despair. Seeing their sorrow is like watching someone yawn, uncontrollable and infectious. Suddenly, and without warning, I'm weeping too. Aunt Margaret passes me a pack of tissues.
Ms. Myers,
Dad says,
perhaps you could give us a quick update on the crash. Is there any new information?
Please, call me Aunt Margaret. And of course, as you may have heard on the news, both black boxes have been recovered, the flight data recorder and the cockpit voice recorder, and they've been sent on to the National Transportation Safety Board for analysis. I do want to warn you, though. Their final report will likely take months, if not years. I wince. A month feels like an eternity, but years? In the meantime,
she pushes a packet of paper an inch thick across the desk and taps a fingertip on a website address printed across the top. This is a dark website, meaning it's not meant for the general public. There are no links leading to it, and only people who type in the exact address will be able to find it. Liberty Airlines will use it to issue statements and provide updates to friends and family of the passengers as soon as information becomes available. You'll also find a list of contact names, phone numbers, and email addresses for every employee on the disaster management team. They are available 24/7, as am I. You are my family, and as such, my very first priority. I look up. What do you mean, we're your family? She smiles at me, not unkindly. Every passenger's family receives their own care specialist. I'm yours. You are my family. If there's anything at all that any of you need, all you have to do is say so, and I'll take care of it. Excellent. You can start with giving me back my husband. Her shoulders fall a good inch, and she tilts her head, reassembling her empathy mask. I wish I could do that, Mrs. Griffith. I really do. I hate this woman. I hate her with such an intensity that for a second or two, I actually blame her for the crash. I know Anne Margaret is not the one who performed the sloppy safety check or who banked left when she should have banked right, but I don't believe her "I'm on your side here" attitude either. If this woman really had my best interests at heart, like she claims, she'd tell me what I really want to hear. How did my husband get on that airplane? It takes Anne Margaret a second or two to register my change of subject, and then she gives me an apologetic smile. I'm sorry. I'm not sure what you mean. What I mean is, did someone actually see him walk on? Because he was late leaving the house, and even if he didn't hit rush hour traffic, which he most probably did, he would have had to haul ass through security and to the terminal. He probably would have been the last person on the plane, if he even made it on time. She shifts in her chair, and she glances at my father, as if to request a little help. When she doesn't get any, her gaze returns to me. Are you asking how Liberty Airlines knows your husband boarded? Yeah, that's exactly what I'm asking. Okay, well, why don't we just back up a minute, then? All airlines have procedures in place, so mistakes like the one you're suggesting could never happen. Passengers' tickets are scanned at the security checkpoint, and then again at the gate, right before they board the plane. Technology doesn't lie. It assures us there are no false positives. I hear Will's scoff as clearly and surely as if he were sitting right here, right beside me. If he were, he'd tell this lady that technology lies by design. Because it is created and controlled by humans. There are bugs, there are crashes, there are false positives and false negatives too,
So Anne Margaret can try to talk me out of beating this particular horse, but as far as I'm concerned, this horse is far from dead. My flare of fury settles into one of self-satisfaction. If Liberty Air can make a mistake as grievous as neglecting to call me before contacting the media, then who's to say Will's name on that passenger manifest isn't another? A gigantic, life-altering mistake, but a mistake all the same. What if, halfway down the jetway, he turned around and went back out? He could have slipped right past the gate agent while she was scanning someone else's ticket. Maybe she didn't even notice.
It's possible, I suppose.
Anne Margaret looks away, and she doesn't bother to conceal her doubt. She doesn't ask the most obvious question, either. Why would anyone turn around and leave? If she did, I'd tell her because it was the wrong flight, headed in the wrong direction.
Perhaps you'd like to speak with someone?
Now we're talking. I'm already nodding, assuming she's referring to her boss, or, better yet, the head of security for Hartsfield.
Religious or secular, we have Red Cross grief counselors on hand, as well as clerics of every major religion. Which would you prefer?
Irritation surges up my chest, lurching me forward in my chair.
I don't need to talk to a psychologist. I am a psychologist. What I need is for someone to tell me where my husband is.
Anne Margaret falls silent. She chews her bottom lip and glances around at her colleagues, stationed at nearby tables and consoling their inconsolables, as if to say, now what? They didn't teach us this one at care specialist training. I've stumped her.
So what now?
My father asks, ever the planner.
What do we do next?
Anne Margaret looks relieved to be prompted back on script. Well, there will be a memorial service this weekend here in town. Liberty Airlines is still working out the logistics, but as soon as I know the time and place, I'll pass it on. I'm available to pick you up at your house and escort you to the service if you'd like. It's of course up to you, but there will be media there, and I'll know the way to get around them.
And if you're interested, I can help plan a visit to the accident site. My throat closes around the last two words. Accident site. I can barely stand seeing the images on television. The idea of walking around the wreckage, of standing on the earth where 179 souls crashed into it, feels like a vicious punch in the gut.
There's no hurry, Anne Margaret says, filling up the silence. When and if you're ready. When I still don't respond, she consults her papers for the next item on the agenda. Oh, yes. Liberty Airlines is working with a third-party vendor to manage the process of returning personal effects to the rightful family members. You'll find the form on page 23 of your packet. The more detail you can provide here, the better. Pictures, inscription texts, distinguishing characteristics, things like that. Will isn't big on jewelry, but he wears a wedding band and a watch. Both were gifts I had engraved with our initials, and both are things I'd want back. Again, you're assuming he was on that plane. My denial, I know, is textbook. I don't believe, therefore, it cannot be true. Will is not buried under Missouri soil. He's in Orlando, dazzling conference attendees with his keynote on predictive analytics and bitching in the hotel bar about the heat. Or maybe he's already home, rumpled and tired from wherever he's been all this time, wondering what's for dinner. I picture myself walking through the door to find him there, and a bubble of joy rises in my chest.
Mrs. Griffith, I realize how difficult this must be, but
do you? Do you really? Because was it your husband on the plane? Was it your mother or father or daughter or son who was blown to bits all over a cornfield? No? Well then, you don't know, and you can't realize how difficult this is for me, for anyone in this room.
Anne Margaret leans into the desk, and her brow crumples.
No. I didn't lose a family member on Flight 23, but I can still feel deep sadness and compassion for you, as well as everyone else here today. I share in your anxiety and distress, and I'm on your side. Tell me what you want.